Romans 3,
verse 9.
Verse 9.
But now, one of the things that you need to know, and you one of the things you need to know is that when you use, for example, and Adon Yehoshua, let me borrow his for a second, the Greek Nazarene codicil, you should understand that if you do any research in Greek, you will find out there are many different manuscripts and codexes, etc. And there are some that are more reliable than others, and others that are not so reliable, etc. But just taking into account that generally speaking, we acknowledge the fact that there's been some tampering with the text, and so it becomes extremely difficult to find out what's happened to the text and how to resolve the issues that are inside the text. And so we employ many different hermeneutics to try to solve these problems. Now, it's very interesting that the statement, the micro part of the statement, which starts off in your typical, I'm going to read here first from a New King James. It said, what then, verse 9, 3-9, what then, are we better than they? Not at all. We have previously charged both the Jews and Greeks that they're all under sin. So, one thing I want to clarify before we jump into this piece of text that's the very opening of the pericope, is that we're not saying by any means that Jews are not subject to sin. So it should never be understood or thought that we're trying to say that the Jewish people are without sin. It's just we need to understand the context. Now, Hakam Shaul is writing the letter to some people in Rome or in Roman territory, so you know that they're in the midst of a very difficult world. Now, I've cited some of my citations run together now. Imagine that. I think it'll be in this coming... Say again?
In the footnotes.
It's in the footnotes. I think it's in this coming week that I will cite Professor Paula Fredrickson. And I have cited her in the past where that she shows that the Jewish perspective or picture of the Gentile in the Roman world was not a good picture. As a matter of fact, you know, when we look at what we call the works of the flesh in Galatians, etc., these things, this is attributed to the Gentile peoples. So the world that Paul or Hakam Shaul is addressing is a world that is plagued with every type of thing that you could possibly imagine. Now, there's another major problem that Hakam Shaul faces with much of what he has to write. And therefore, you need to understand the negativity of what he is arguing with and what he's arguing against. So, if you were Jewish in the kingdom of Rome, the Roman kingdom, then you were excluded from having to go to the pagan temples, etc., and worship foreign deities, etc. So, this is not a problem for the Jewish people by and large, but it is a problem for Hakam Shaul's audience. Why?
Because they're not Jewish yet, they have to go.
They're not proselytes yet, but even if they're...
Gentiles.
they're Gentile, and if they're not yet full converts, they don't have the same privilege. You understand? Mm-hmm. So that means...
they come in conflict with the authorities.
Exactly. So if you've got someone that says, I'm not going to go, he needs to either prove that he's Jewish, or he's going to go, and he's going to be there amidst sacrifices that were not sacrifices to God, etc. Okay, so it's a very, very tough, a very, very difficult world that's trying to be balanced in this situation and that Chacham Shaul is addressing. Now back to the text, if you look at the opening piece where in your, whatever version you're reading from, it says, what then, are we better than they? Now I'm using a New King James here, and in my New King James, we have the word what then, and then it says, are we better, and then the next two words are in italics. Is that the way you see what you're looking at?
Yes.
Okay, so then let's just read it like that. What then? Are we better? So, if we just left it like that, you can take for granted those words can or cannot be there. But the difficulty is then the next phrase, which looks like not at all. Okay? The truth is, with this particular piece of material, that, and if you go to the Christian bookstore, and Adon Scott will help you select the books that you need to look at, but if you look at the authors and the commentators on this particular verse alone, just this one verse alone, you're going to find everything from positivity to negativity. Because it is very, very difficult to translate this particular phrase. And this particular phrase, it seems like, you know, it can go this way or it can go that way. So, now let's stop and ask ourselves a question. If you can go back. To three. We can go back to 3, 1 through 8, and I'll just read from my translation, but you can make yourself a little notebook and keep the translation along with you if you so choose. Therefore, what advantage, I'm at 3, 1 now reading from my translation, what is the advantage of being Jewish? How are they favored? Or what is the purpose of circumcision? And then we do this very much in a free translation style. Say they have every advantage, priority, privilege, preeminence, altogether great and important. Most importantly, first, God entrusted his oracles to them and placed them within their custody. So, that being said, when we come now to Romans 3 and 9, would you expect Chacham Shaul to automatically turn around and negate everything that he just said?
No.
So, then if he said that they have the advantage, and he has said this now, this being the third pericope, that he points out the advantage of the Jewish people that they have, he's not going to come to this place and turn around all of a sudden and say, yeah, are we better off than they? No, not at all. So he has already even said, he said, we're the ones who have the premier privilege. We're the ones that had the prior advantage. Why a prior advantage? Because they have the Torah. Okay, so not only do they have the written Torah, they have the oral Torah as well. And these two versions of the Torah running congruent with one another. Now, let me here look. So, I think it should be abundantly clear that now when we come to this piece of text here in 9 and we read this, all of a sudden you should be able to see immediately that there's something wrong. Everybody with me?
Mm-hmm.
So, we have followed two or three, if you look in the footnotes, you'll see that we followed two or three different scholars, several different scholars, as a matter of fact. And some are arguing for it, some are arguing against. But it's so very interesting that what they do is somebody gives up the goods. Somebody says, well, guess what? It really should say this. And so you go like, well, why did you say that? Because you know that if you say that and it's the truth, that you're committing scholarly suicide. And I've got a couple of books in the library back there that you can read the book, but start looking for other works. And the scholastic community, the scholarly community, has abandoned these people because they tell the truth.
Not just they tell the truth, they tell the unpopular truth.
They tell the real truth. And they don't care whether it's popular or not. They say exactly what it is. Okay. So, when we came out and went through the process of studying this and researching this, it comes out to, you know, what then? Do we Jews have a prior advantage? This is absolutely. And then we understand this as being the fact that they've been given the Torah. And he said, for we have already shown that both Jews and Hellenists are subject to sin, being at the hands of the wicked, as it is written. Have the workers of wickedness no knowledge? Okay, so this is what is very interesting, and it puts us right in the middle of the 7 weeks of Nahamu, and begins to deal with different aspects of the different officers in the Esnoga. And he has woven 10 pearls together. And the 10 pearls are where you have to derive your hermeneutic from. Okay? So what is the difficulty that the Jews and the Hellenists face when they're in the world, in the diaspora?
Getting killed.
Absolutely. If they, if you will excuse the expression, if they know that you're circumcised, then they want to circumcise your neck. Right below your head, right? So, okay, we don't need you anymore. Okay, so it turns out to be that here they are living in a world that is exactly the opposite of anything that they're trying to promote. Let's see if I can find a little verse here. Let's find, I thought this was 17. Jeremiah 16:16. Okay, yeah, verse 19. Excuse me.
Yeah.
16:19. O Lord, my strength and my fortress, my refuge in the day of my affliction. The Gentiles will come to you from the ends of the earth, and they will say, surely our fathers inherited lies, worthlessness and unprofitable things. So this is what Jeremiah says, that the Gentiles will say, then obviously now you will come to the place that you're starting to see why we use the phrase and we cite the phrase that in some cases we'll say human attempts to please God. Okay, now this will go for both Jews and Gentiles, but it is specifically a Gentile problem. Why is it such a Gentile problem?
Because it's actually masking rebellion when they try to do their own thing and think they're smart enough to do, figure out how to please God.
So, in other words, what they say is, I don't need somebody to teach me the Torah. I can figure it out on my own. Okay? And this is somewhat back to the situation of Adam and Chava, where Adam says, oh, well, you know, I did something that's wrong, so now I'll fix it. I'll just cover myself with a fig leaf. Problem solved. Right? In his mind, that's what he did. He's going to solve the atonement problem, right? By making some form of a covering for himself. And so you can see it in humanity all the way along. What they have a tendency to do is think that, guess what? I don't need to listen to anybody else. I don't need to have somebody teach me what the Torah says. I'm smart enough to figure it out for myself. Matter of fact, I'm so smart that I know that even though it says that you put the fringes on the corners of your garment, we'll just substitute and we'll put them on our belt loops.
That's all I'm going to say about that.
That's actually better than what I came away with when I read it the first time.
It kind of reminds me of something about, you know, young kids when they try to cover up something they've done. We know that they've done.
They always tell them themselves, right?
Well, when I first read it, I thought it meant you had to put a blue string like down the fringe of all your garments, and I was like, that doesn't. I've never seen anybody with that. That doesn't seem right.
You are very astute, my young friend. Very astute. Okay, so. Now, here's what you need to be able to do. Here's what you need to understand with the hermeneutic problem. Have you answered the hermeneutic question yet?
I asked a hermeneutic question. That's Jewish of me, to answer a question.
So in other words, you're saying no, right?
That is correct.
So everybody knows where the word hermeneutics comes from.
Hermes?
The Greek messenger, God messenger, and?
Pneumatic.
Pneuma, which is the spirit. So, what's he supposed to be doing? Give us the spirit of the message, the spiritual aspect of the message, okay? So that's where the idea of hermeneutic comes from, okay? Meaning the spiritual intent or the spiritual aspect of the text. However, that is not 100% accurate because we're not just, quote, wanting to spiritualize any piece of text, okay? Now, what Chacham Shaul does is what we call stringing pearls. It's a very rabbinic thing. And he strings them together, and he strings 10 pearls together, as we've shown. But if you now look at the commentary, not on that page.
39. String 10 pearls. It's 39.
Actually, I'm on page 37. Textual analysis. Mm-hmm. Okay. One thing you should do. If you're going to give a homily, give a lecture, give a message concerning the text, in this case we're talking about the text of the Greek to the Romans, the letter to the Romans by Chacham Shaul, and then we have to go into the Remez rules of hermeneutics. Now, we post every week the Peshat hermeneutics. We've not done the Remez for some time, but you can look back and find Remez. Or you can look in the Siddur, the Yorot Siddur. We read it every week. Giveret Gibor reads it for us. So she has all the hermeneutic rules memorized.
Yes.
She knows
the words
it's...
anyway. No. I'm getting there.
Okay. Seventh hermeneutic rule of Remez is from a generality that requires an elucidation by the specific, and the specific requires an elucidation by the general. The rule 9 reads as follows. Anything that was a part of a general principle was later singled out to discuss another point similar to the general principle, was singled out in order to be more lenient and not to be more stringent. Some people need to read that of half a dozen times. Okay? But the point is that there's generalities and there's specifics. Okay? So what Hakam Shaul has been doing for us is laying down some specific rules, some specific understanding that we need to come to an understanding of. Do the Jews have an advantage? Absolutely have an advantage. Okay? So if he's telling you that it has an advantage, then you have to understand. I'm jumping around again. If they have an advantage, then guess what? It cannot be to the place that you turn around and say, oh, not at all. And that's exactly what happens in the King James Version, the different versions, a lot of scholarly things. They don't have a hermeneutic. And so if they don't have a hermeneutic to adhere to, then what can they do? They can just say whatever they want. And then the 12th hermeneutic rule of Remez is that a matter derived from context. You have to always maintain context. We will also do what we call a chorale hermeneutics. So if you don't understand chorale hermeneutics, I will teach you right now what a chorale is. And then you will understand exactly how we have to go about following the hermeneutic of deciding how you interpret your text. Okay? So, if we take a text and we have a Torah Seder, and it is in the Bamidbar, and you can pick out the Perikop, and then we come and we have a Psalm, and then we have a Prophet, and which is the Ashlamatah, and then sometimes we'll have a Special. Okay? And then you have all of these things. Now here is your chorale. Okay? So you look at this text before you even think about turning and opening your book to the Nazarene Codicil. You go to the Torah Seder and you read the Torah Seder. Preferably you read it in in more than one translation. Half a dozen will work. Start off with the JPS. Read it in several versions so that you can see the different way that things are worded, etc. By all means, you should be learning Hebrew, or you should be trying to read in Hebrew the text. And there are plenty of wonderful Hebrew interlinears that are around. If not, talk with Don Scott. He'll help you find one. I try to jump up a little bit. So first you start with the Torah Seder, then you go to the Psalm, and you read the Psalm. And the question that should be running through your head when you go to the Psalm is,
how is this going to act with Torah Seder?
Why did he write this piece of Psalm, and how does this reflect the Torah Seder? There's something in connection with it. Everybody should be well aware of the fact that Psalm is divided into five books, right? Okay, if you're a mathematical genius, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. How many books of the Torah are there?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
There are five.
Five.
Somewhere.
Is that amazing?
Chumash.
Chumash means five. Okay. An interesting question, side note, sidetrack. David went down to the brook and he picked up 5 smooth stones. Why did David pick up 5 smooth stones? Well, if you want the typical Christian answer, I'll tell you. He had 4 gloves.
J-E-S-U-S.
Well, I heard
him.
Yeah. What? J-E-S-U-S. Well, I don't know how that works out. Okay, so it should be simple enough, right? David is thinking all of the different books of the Torah, Seder, or Torah, and he's saying, look, you know, this, and he calls him what? He says to Goliath, he said, you're an uncircumcised a Philistine, a Gentile, and guess what's going to happen to you?
About to rock his world.
David was... he had to throw the beginning at him, right? Right? Barosh. Right in the head.
In the head.
But he had this fascination. David had this fascination with the head. Because what did he do to him?
Chopped it off.
Yep. Comes and he chops his head off with his own sword.
Yes, this 12-year-old boy picked up Goliath's sword and swung it by.
I've always read that statement that said David was a man who knew how to get ahead in God's kingdom. Everybody knew that, right? Okay. So you know that David is turning back into the Torah Seder. He's saying that something out of the Torah Seder inspired him. And then the same thing happens with the prophets, okay? When we read the prophets, we read the prophet and we must ask the question, what did the prophet find in the material that made him write this particular piece of text? Then, after you've done all of this in the special, then when you come to the Nazarene Codicil, you have another problem, right? Because you have Peshat, Hakam Sefetz Peshat, before you get to Remes, and you got Tosefta here. Okay? And then you got the Remes. So look what happens to the guy that's bringing up the rear. He's got the easiest job, right? He has to connect 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 pieces of material and coalesce them into his material. Walk in the park.
Where is the 6 come from? What is Tosefta?
Sometimes we have the Tosefta. Tosefta is Luke. If you look at your front page of the Nazarene Codex, page 34. See at the top, we have on the right-hand side, Peshat, Mordecai, which is Mark. And then we have Tosefta of Luke, which is Hakam Shul's school. Tosefta means additions. Now, something you yeshiva students need to memorize and know. Tosefta is like a pendulum swinging in the balance. And so you need to know, and you will be asked on occasion, does the Tosefta lean harder toward Peshat or Remes?
Back and forwards.
Okay, so what you'll need to know in specific pericopes and Torah Seirim, which way does it go? Okay. Did anybody else besides me, when they read Luke, get amazed? Says, you don't remember now?
I don't remember if I got amazed.
Well, maybe I can help you out. Repent.
Oh.
Repent.
Yes.
And repent again.
Yes.
And this was for Elul the fourth, the first Sabbath in Elul. What does that mean?
Repent.
We turned into the month of repentance. Does anybody think we could be right on target?
Get ready for Yom Teruah.
I heard that Teruah in here a while ago. It sounded like somebody was butchering a calf.
No, it wasn't butchering. That might have been done correctly. This one was being strangled.
Okay. All right. So do you see Tosefta now, Ruth? I know that opens up many more questions, right? Okay. Let's try to work out our hermeneutic here, because I'm trying to help inquiring minds. So now go back. Page 37.
We're discussing something he says.
We were passing notes the other day.
Okay. So you then have, in this case, you have six pieces of material before you get to Remes. And so Chacham Shaul does something very interesting to show his spiritual genius. He does a stringing of pearls with 10 pearls, and he uses the 10 pearls to be his answer and his commentary, number one, to the Torah, number two, to the problem of Jews or Jewish people in diaspora. So then when we begin to look at this, he cites a particular Psalm 54 as the first pearl. And he says, "Have the workers of wickedness no knowledge, who eat up my people as though they ate bread, and have not called upon God?" So then you know that he's trying to say or answer the problem of the Jews being in diaspora. What are they going to face? What difficulties will they face? And so then, because you know that what he's doing is stringing pearls, you can see the pearls, you can see each one of them clearly. I mark them out for everyone to be able to see. Then what you can do is go back to the beginning of the text. As you go back to the beginning of the text, it said, "What then? Do we Jews have a prior advantage?" Absolutely. And then he said, "For we've already shown both that Jews and Hellenes are also subject to sin." So we are saying clearly they still are subject to sin. All of us are subject to sin. No one is above that. Okay? But the difficulty is that here we are in the Gentile world, subject to the world, the sinful world, the world of diaspora. And so there's tremendous difficulties in trying to understand and be able to work out logistics in this particular world. Okay. If you've not been to Israel, you're missing, first of all, a great treat. And the Bible truly does come alive when you go. But one of the beautiful things about being in the Jewish world in Eretz Israel is the fact that we're just going to use something very simple, is, for example, kosher food. When you go to the place that you will stay, you don't have to look for a heksher. Some people might.
What about bagels on Passover?
I don't think you're going to find any there unless you go to the Christian quarter.
You don't remember that. Never mind.
So,
you can go to places in Israel and you say, well, what am I going to eat today? And so you go to cafeteria and you go over there and you get your schnitzel and rice and your little pita bread and go through the line, and they've got this partition right down the middle of the cafeteria. If you eat your schnitzel, you gotta stay on this side. If you get ice cream, you gotta stay on that side. Never will the two mix. So, in Israel, it's easy. It's easy to keep kosher. It's easy to do spiritual things. It's easy to follow the mitzvah because you're in that particular environment. And so, what we are trying to do here in Paris is generate an environment very much like that. To where that if you come to my house, the food is kosher. Come to Don Yoel's house, food is kosher. The food is kosher. Etc., etc. So you're trying to generate that environment. But now we say here the reason why we're saying that the Jews have such difficulty or are further exposed to sin is because they're in the environment that propagates that. It's not to say that they will not commit any type of sin if they're in Eretz Israel, etc. But the thing is, it's much easier when you have community and when you are in the environment. Okay? So this is what Hakam Shaul is trying to say. That here is this particular environment, the difficulty that we have. Okay. Now we'll come back to this in just a minute. Let's go. Well, let me ask a question first. We've shown you some basics in trying to read Hakam Shaul's mind is very disconcerting. But let me ask you a couple of questions. Okay, so I'm going to pick on it on Scott for just a minute. Is that okay?
That's fine.
So, I hear it on Scott's teaching his lesson, and he cites a passage and he says, from Corinthians, he says, the letter kills, but the Spirit brings life. So don't Scott, does that mean that the written Torah is what kills and the Spirit brings life? Does that say then that we can set the Torah aside? Or are both comments a positive comment, or is one positive and the other negative?
Well, from a Christian perspective, I would say that they're talking about, when it says the letter kills, they're talking about the law.
Okay.
Wait. So that would be a negative, I guess.
Okay.
And then the Spirit would be a positive.
Positive. That's generally how it's viewed. And it's not something that I had said in the past. So, one day, I'm contemplating this tremendous difficulty with why this guy says, and he does in 7:14, Romans 7:14, and you can look there, and he said the Torah is spiritual. Wait. So if the Torah is spiritual, then you're telling me the letter kills, and it's supposed to be a negativity, then there is a big problem here. You've got to figure out what he's trying to say, whether it's a positive or negative. Okay, so now I will, from a Jewish perspective, say they're both positives. Okay? How can they both be positive?
Because the Torah would, by giving us a
guide to go by. It kills sin, it kills unrighteousness, it kills lawlessness.
So in other words, we could say that what the letter is killing is anything that hinders me in my relationship with God.
But I had another perspective as well.
Okay.
All right. We know that reading the Torah without knowing the spirit of it can lead to errors and worse things than just plain
sure.
sin.
Sure.
So,
well, let's put it in its right environment, okay? So when it's in its correct environment, can it kill? Absolutely. It can kill all day long. Do you want it to kill? Absolutely. I want it to kill anything that causes me to be put at bay from the presence of God. So both statements are positives. Does it kill? Absolutely it kills. Is it okay that it kills? Yes, it's okay that it kills. But now, in some circles, they're going to say, but the letter kills. And so if you're in that environment and they say that it kills, they don't stop to ask the question, what's being killed? And they just take it as 100% negativity and that we can't have any of that. So, what I'm telling you about Hacham Cha'ul is if he's going to be pro-Torah and he's saying something that's pro-Torah, for example, he'll say in 7:14, he says the law is spiritual. Look at 7 in... Romans 7:7. He's been talking about the fact that the Torah will elucidate what sin is. And then, in verse 7, he said, what will we say then? Is the Torah sin? His answer is?
No, certainly not.
Absolutely not. On the contrary, I wouldn't have known what sin was except through the Torah. Now, let's go to page 35. Where are we at on the clock? What let's do is let's read... I'm going to read from the New King James. Therefore, the deeds of the law, no flesh will be justified in his sight, for the law is knowledge of sin.
So you're back in Romans 3.
Yeah, I'm back in Romans 3. Let's go back to verse 19. I need to be in 19. Whatever the law says, it says to those who are under the law. Whatever the Torah says, it says to those that are under the Torah. Positive or negative statement?
Positive.
Absolutely. But how has it been read?
Negative.
Absolutely negative. It's not a negative statement. What he's saying is, if you want to know the Torah, ask somebody that knows it. Ask somebody that practices it. So, you know, you're a young lady. You just got married, and you want to contemplate beginning your family. And so you want to know, you know, what it's like to carry the baby for 9 months. And of course, what you want to do is go ask the rabbi, right?
Yeah.
Huh? Does the rabbi have a clue what it's all about? No, the rabbi is going to say, go talk to Rabbani. She knows what it's all about. I can't tell you what it's like to carry that baby. I can tell you what she was like when she carried the baby for 9 months.
Watch it.
Okay, but you understand here, if you want to understand the Torah, you don't go down to... I won't say it like that. You need to go to the place where somebody can teach you the Torah that already knows the Torah. Because if somebody disagrees with the Torah and they're going to tell you that it's no good, then are you going to learn anything about the Torah?
Tell the truth.
So, back to my translation, page 35, it said, now, we know that whatever the Torah says, it speaks to those who are under its authority. Why? So that every mouth may be stopped and the whole cosmos may be held accountable to God. And this is, get your little inner linear out and look at it. You'll see it. That's what it says. So now it's interesting. Why does God decide that He's going to use the Torah to stop the mouth of everybody in the entire cosmos? And how in the world is He going to do that? And we said in the commentary, He praised the Jewish people past everybody and said, now, if you want to cry that you couldn't do it? Keep this in mind. It'll be something to look at in coming parable. So nobody's justified by trying to do something on their own merit or by their own power, etc. But here the point that is being made, the Chacham Shaul is trying to reiterate to us and strengthen and reinforce to us, is listen, you need a teacher. You don't need five teachers, you need a teacher. So now, am I saying I am the only teacher? Absolutely not. As a matter of fact, what I say is His Eminence is the teacher. That's all I'm saying. He is. I'm not. You want to know how these things came out of the translation? It's by His having invested in my life a considerable amount of research and study, etc. So I am not the sharpest pencil in a drawer, but you know, I'm smart enough to figure out if Paul said that the Jews or the Torah is spiritual, and somebody's come along and they're saying exactly the opposite, then there's a problem somewhere. And I may have to scratch my head three ways from whatever to try to figure it out. And I may stare at the text until, you know, I just can't take it anymore. But one thing God has been faithful to do is say, here's the answer. And some of it's, as His Eminence would say, 99% perspiration and 1% inspiration. If you don't do the work, you won't get the results. Do I really enjoy having to go through the briar patch?
Yeah.
To get to the other side?
Yeah, it's a hickey, sure do.
I learned a job today that it's at a farmer's field. In the farmer's field, there's some spots where the water's been ponding. And so he says, I need to solve this problem. So he says, there's a ditch inside of those woods. You need to be able to carry the water from here into the woods to the ditch so the water will run out. So what do I have to do? Get me and my little trusty machine and we head through the woods. Briars! Bear the marks on your flesh, right? But did I receive the reward? I came out on the other side. There was no ditch. So the farmer's in trouble. But I got the answer. Why? Because I went through the briars. But what I'm trying to say here is there is a considerable amount of work that has to be done. And it's our job to do the work. But I'm not here to pat myself on the back. If I say that we need to listen to the voices of the Hakamim, I'm not trying to say you need to listen to my voice. But if it appears in this Torah Seder, the material appears in this Torah Seder, you can rest assured that his eminence had his fingers on it. One way or the other. And that may be by him saying, you know, your eminence, Rabbi Eliyahu, I don't understand your translation. Or, you should have said this, or you should have said that. Now, please don't think that he is overbearing in any ways. He's always very insightful and very inspiring. You go, why didn't I see that to begin with? But after you've been with his eminence, Doniel can attest, Gibrit Yord, Adon Sriel, been with us many years now, you know that his eminence is not going to let you off the hook with the first answer that comes to your head. Am I right?
Well, is that the truth?
As a matter of fact, it's kind of like, you know, going down to the lake to catch fish. The first fish you catch, throw it back in, because that's not going to work. He's going to want some other fish. Okay?
More meat.
Chunky.
So, what we're saying here is not, I'm not trying to put feathers in my own hat. My insight is basically the product of having worked with his eminence for some time and not willing to compromise the fact that the Torah is what we absolutely need. Okay, go back to page 34. We'll sum up. Now, having seen, at least crudely, how the hermeneutic process works, we can read the first part of the paragraph. What then? Do we Jews have a prior advantage? Absolutely, abundantly. For we have already shown that both the Jews, the Jewish people, and the Hellenists are also subject to sin. Especially so when they're at the hands of the wicked, or they live with the wicked. Okay? Why? I always love Psalms 2. Puts God in this merry state of existence. Says, he that sits in the heavens will laugh.
And put them in derision.
And have them totally in confusion. Why? Because they imagine vain things against him and his anointed. So, it said, have the workers of wickedness no knowledge who eat up my people? Apparently they don't. And he said, as though they ate bread and have not called upon God. He said, the fool. Who's the fool? The wicked who oppresses or tries to eat up the people of God has said in his heart, there is no God. They're corrupt and they've committed abominable works. So now you know what a human attempt to keep the Torah is. Adam, where are you? Okay, let me ask you a question. If you don't see the answer to that question in this Torah Seder, keep your eyes open. Because the answer will be in the next one. Why did God say to Adam, where are you? Okay? Adam and Chava, we've discussed enough in this Torah Seder. They commit abominable works against God. They cover themselves with a fig leaf as if this was going to solve the problem. Indeed, there's not a righteous, generous man on the earth who continually does good and who never sins. Amen. We're not saying that the Jewish people are beyond sin. We're saying that even the tzaddik, the righteous man, he sins. Number three, the Lord has looked down from heaven upon the sons of men to see if they there was any who understood, who seeks after God, for all have turned aside together, and they have become corrupt, and there is not one who does good, not even one. He is not speaking specifically about the Jewish people, but the Jewish people, you can say, yeah, they are subject to sin. They do sin. But the address and the attack that he's making here is not on the Jewish people.
No, because you can go and look at the Torah and see the righteous, how they acted.
Exactly.
So that would not describe them.
In that fashion. The throat is an open sepulcher. They use their tongues to deceive. They sharpen their tongues as a serpent. Now this could be read in the positive, because the Hakamim are often called serpents in a positive way. Poison of a viper is under their lips, Selah. His mouth is full of curses and deceit and oppression, etc. Go to page 38, the very bottom, not the footnotes, but the last sentence says, a bolded text is a direct translation of the Greek text. The text is not bolded, it's derived from the context cited in Psalms 53:4. The people of Jews are subject to sin. A sinful world, those who would eat up my people, is therefore the environment is sinful for the Jewish people. Therefore, those people that have committed abominable works of the Gentiles who have attempted to please God. So in other words, you see the Gentiles, and I don't care what title you want to give them. Okay? I'm not being sarcastic. I don't care who it is, and I'm not trying to look down on the Gentiles, but you can see it every day in the world that they are doing it their own way. When you see the ones that are really intelligent, you see them in the yeshiva, because they said, "Wait a minute, this is the Torah. I need an explanation here that I'm not going to get." Etc. Okay? So they realize the beauty of the truth of the, when they realize the beauty of the truth that Yeshua is an Orthodox Jewish rabbi, they make a decision to accept the Jewishness of Yeshua. However, they reject the sages and their explanation of how to follow the Torah. Therefore, there, the Gentiles' attempts are nothing more than human attempts to please God, abominable works, and against the Torah nomos. Their rejection of the Masorah, the Oral Torah, leaves them with their abominable devices. This is nothing more than Christian dogma wearing a tallit and legalism. This is of their own, a legalism of their own making. We can clearly understand that no one is justified in God's sight by personal attempts without the guidance of a Torah teacher to keep the Torah, since the Torah comes the intimate knowledge of sin. How will we understand? Now we know that whatever the Torah says, it speaks to those who are under its authority, i.e. the Jewish Hakamim. In other words, the Torah is being spoken and has been spoken to the Jewish people, the true authorities of the Torah. The ones who are the recipients of the, what? The oracles of God. And he placed it in their custody, I said. Then the Torah speaks to the Jewish people who live and function as recipients of his oracles, placing them in their custody. And why has God spoken the Torah to those under the authority of the authorities from within the superstructure of the Torah? So that the mouth may be stopped of the whole cosmos, may be held accountable to God. Now, as we close, go back to your trustworthy translation, whichever version that is. and answer me a question. Verse 21. Read it for a second. I'll give you a second. I'll take a drink of water. You got a question. You got an answer for me.
Of course, this is the new one that's just come out.
The one that you have picked up or received this evening or been in your email this week, yes. But I am going to read from this version here, then you'll just have to see how we fix this problem.
I already saw.
You did? Watch what he says now. You've been getting the material that says the Jews are at advantage. And the Torah is going to be flaunted before the whole cosmos, and everybody's going to see it, and the Jewish people paraded before the whole cosmos.
And the whole cosmos becomes guilty.
And the whole cosmos becomes guilty because of it.
And that's why they're accountable.
Now the righteousness of God, apart from the Torah, is revealed, being witnessed by the Torah and the prophets. Wait. I'm confused. Wait a minute. Now the righteousness of God, apart from the Torah, is revealed, being witnessed by the Torah and the prophets. Wait a minute. If you're going to tell me that the Torah is no good, then you can't cite the Torah as something that's going to testify to the benefit of something else. You see what I'm saying? Adon Suriel probably had a little bit of this in his policeman days. You know, you got this guy, they call him a snitch. You trust every word that guy said? No, because he's a criminal too. So if you're going to tell me the Torah is not validated anymore, then all of a sudden you tell me that you're going to use it as a testimony? There's a problem. And not only that, look at here, he says, but the righteousness of God apart from the Torah. In other words, there's some other standard that is superior to the Torah, apart from the Torah. And I say,
baloney.
Questions and comments? What are you going to do with your hermeneutic?
You know, it would be so much simpler if they just written it in English.
We're going to have a long conversation.
We have this new language that's in our translations called Christianology, right?
Yeah, but that makes
no sense. Well, Zimonis will tell you clearly in your Greek class that, you know, it matters where you put that comma or that period. But I think he pointed out as well is that guess what? If you've got a theology or an ideology behind you, that's where you're going to put your period. If you like it the way that it says it, then you can have it. All you got to do is just adjust the periods to make it say what you want to say. Nobody would do that. Surely not.
Just put the period just right in and make one big wrong sense.
In Greek, many of them are exactly that way. Where do you put this period? You look in the Greek text, it has no period in there, and you put a period in there, what do you do that for?
Punctuation didn't even exist until, what, a few hundred years ago?
Yeah, so that means that you have to understand what is an exclamation point, what is a bulleted list, etc. 10 things, 10 scriptures. Is that a bulleted list?
Mm-hmm.
side in two.
Any other questions or comments? If Chacham Shaul is saying that the Torah is for us to keep and for us to be obedient to without legalism, and the text starts to say the contrary, we need a backup.